Coming up in this podcast, WA borders, unemployment statistics, housing sales, VGW, Woodside jobs, curtain building collapse, charity boon, governance issues and biggest exporters.
Welcome to Mark My Words, the weekly podcast from Business News with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer discussing the important business news and data stories from Western Australia.
Welcome to our weekly podcast and welcome Mark Beyer. But good to have you back after a bit of a break. Mark, the big discussion this week has been when do we start to relax our borders?
We had a breakfast during the week with the Health Minister and Deputy Premier Roger Cook. We had a nice big audience there for that breakfast, and it was a really insightful presentation from him. And then we had a Q&A, and he was really talking about this very difficult situation the government finds itself in, essentially saying, yes, we're now at a point where we're going to have to make a decision about the border.
Yeah.
Now, some of the reporting around it has been interesting because on the same day, you know, the Premier was asked questions on the same topic along with the Chief Health Officer. And, you know, their responses were all a bit different. Some people have seized on the differences in the way they talked about the topic. But I think what runs through all of them is this agreement that we can't continue with the current policy settings.
Yeah, the pressure's on, right?
Yeah. The rest of the country is getting their act together. Victoria, as a result of their very tough restrictions, has just about got on control of COVID. New South Wales has some bubbling issues, but generally in control. And other states, South Australia, Queensland, have got good numbers coming through.
Yeah.
So Western Australia is going to have to change.
So the dilemma seems to be, initially anyway, is we've got it. We're on phase four, so we're not completely, we're not completely without restrictions. We're due to go to phase five in the next week or so. But, and I think this is the question, you wouldn't go to phase five and start opening up your borders. You'd leave them at phase four, or maybe even restrict a bit more in case, you know, who knows. Now, you know, West Australians are enjoying their freedom, and that's been part of the debate, that, you know, that perhaps we've enjoyed it too much and we're too relaxed, and therefore open up the borders and you get a problem. The Premier has already...
Sorry, hopefully it doesn't keep on happening.
No worries, we'll just grab a drink. The Premier has also indicated, you know, whether he meant to or not, that there's some economic benefits for the state in this, which we'll get to in a minute. I think the criticism the government's getting is that they've been saying it's always on health. So it's a health advice. But then when you've got, you know, your chief medical officer suggesting that there is room to open borders or it is potentially a possibility, suddenly it all gets a bit awkward.
Well, I noticed Roger Cook kept on using the phrase that health is the bedrock for their decision making.
Yeah, right.
But obviously in allowing other factors to be weighed up as well.
Yeah.
As you would expect in terms of sort of the economic and commercial impact of it.
Yeah.
And look, you're right. Arguably, you could go one way, you could ease the border restrictions, but continue with limits on having large gatherings within Western Australia.
Yeah.
Or you go the other way, maintain the hard border, but free up things entirely within Western Australia.
And both have their advantages and disadvantages, right? So economically, you know, things are pretty good now. 85-90% of the population think this is great, and that's why Mark McGowan's sticking with it, because he knows he's on a vote winner. But there are issues coming out of it, and there are industries that are suffering. There are individuals who, you know, for family reasons can't move, and all sorts of other job opportunities and business opportunities they're missing out on. So longer term, we know. And I mean, if I've got a criticism of the current policy, it's that there's just not been enough effort to find niche opportunities to, you know, the South Australians are bringing students in on a small scale. Why are we doing that? You know, we've got, you know, fishing companies and the like want to transfer fishermen, international fishermen. We're not even trying to explore those things. So I think that's a bit disappointing. We should be letting every Australian who wants to come back to Perth back into this state right now because they've got bags of money.
Yeah, and in fact, that was one of the questions that was put to Roger Cook during the week, was around that. It said, well, if you choose to maintain the hard border, what flexibility can you then layer on top of that?
Correct.
So that people can travel more flexibly or with more freedom, whether it's for family reasons or whether it's for business reasons. I found it a bit frustrating that the Premier and others keep on saying, well, that's a matter for the police commissioner. And at an operational level, that's certainly the case. But I think, you know, given the significance of this issue, it's certainly something where guidance from government would be very useful.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's a classic example of politics where, you know, they think, probably thought, right, we can hold the line till March, and suddenly it's not as easy as that. So, be interesting. Now, look, on that line, there were some big statistics out this week. Firstly, unemployment.
Yeah, and look, Ben Wyatt, the Treasurer, seized on these numbers to push the government's line that Western Australia has benefited from the hard border and keeping the virus under control. So look, at a national level, there was a bit of a fall in jobs, but you know, given the way things are at the moment, these numbers are very volatile. You know, there was a huge increase in employment in August, but then a fall in September. Notably, the unemployment rate in Western Australia, it lowered to 6.7%. So that's now equal lowest of any state in the country.
Yeah.
Whereas not long ago, you know, Western Australia had one of the worst unemployment rates. Yeah, there was some growth in employment in Western Australia, about 3,000 jobs created, so that was encouraging. Ben Wyatt made the point that he said 73% of all the jobs that were lost due to COVID have now been recovered. So it's this theme that, you know, we're on the way back. And notably, that number was even better for women who were... female employment suffered disproportionately, and he's saying that it's bouncing back strongly.
Were there any stats around JobKeeper, Mark, and how many people on JobKeeper in WA?
Not in this series, no.
No.
And you know, and that's one of the issues around here, that there's this official measure of unemployment, but then there's, you know, underemployment and all the people that are sitting there on JobKeeper, and as soon as that finishes, their status will change. So that's the numbers are a bit muddy at best.
And then coupled with that, there's a housing boom going on in the state.
That's right. And look, and as you touched on a moment ago, there are a lot of expats who want to come back to Western Australia, and Australia generally. That's already happening. And you know, every indication that there's a lot more. You know, once again, difficult to get hard numbers on this, but anecdotally, you know, I'm hearing from a lot of people that there's this sort of increasing demand. And of course, as COVID gets worse in Europe, as it is at the moment, and continues to be a big issue in the US and most other parts of the world, you know, it's clearly not this short-term blip. It's going to be a long-term problem.
Well, I think they say 100,000 people want to come back to Australia still.
So one of the beneficiaries of that is the residential property market, contrary to expectations. So the latest data that's come out from the Real Estate Institute of Western Australia is that houses in Perth sold 27 days faster in September than at the same time last year, along with a 20% decrease in the number of properties listed for sale. So Damien Collins, the REWA president, you know, he talked about some very significant improvements happening around the state, and then logically the expectation is this will flow through to property values as well.
Absolutely. And you've got building construction boom as well, because the builders have all got there's all these incentives for people to build houses, to the point where some builders are saying no more, correct?
Well, that's right, because there's a tight time frame when they need to commence construction, and a lot of them are saying, well, we're struggling. There's too many people out there all of a sudden.
Yeah, so there'll be tradie shortage. There'll be poor construction. There'll be a whole lot of issues that come out of this, won't there?
So certainly residential property and residential property construction, they're two of the areas that have been, in a way, unexpected beneficiaries of COVID.
Absolutely. Now, of course, not all the economic impact is local. Interesting to see a company like VGW, its results based on global gambling trends.
So VGW, it's not a particularly well-known business, but it's actually a tech success story in Perth. It used to be called Virtual Gaming Worlds. So they create online gaming. They're very... they've actually had a spectacular improvement in their business, yeah. And they've attributed it to the fact that...
people are locked down.
Essentially, it's in, reduced travel, working from home, more flexible time, led to a big increase in demand for their services. So their annual revenue more than doubled to about $800 million.
Crikey.
Now, their core market is North America. So it's an unlisted business based in Perth, with a gaming license in Malta, but operations in North America. Fascinating story.
Yeah.
Annual profit, $72 million.
Crikey, that's amazing, isn't it?
A dividend of $35 million. Now, there aren't many tech startups. Well, they're not really a startup. They've been going for 10 years.
Yeah.
But there aren't many tech businesses that are making those sorts of profits and paying out those sorts of dividends.
In WA.
Absolutely, and look, the business has been going about 10 years. They only turned their first profit, I think, 2.5 or 3 years ago. And suddenly, they've hit boom time.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting model too, and I've had a little bit to do with it, watched it from a distance for a while, and I guess they were looking at listing and all sorts of things. I think they've struggled around that because there's a whole lot of regulatory issues they've got to get around in their business, not necessarily to list it. And so I think there's a lot of risk there. So I think it sounds like they're just making hay whilst the sun shines. Having built a business that is making a great profit, they're probably just going, well, let's enjoy this rather than trying to, rather than knowing how sustainable it is. That would be my gut feeling around that. Now, on the other side of the coin, speaking of global economic impact, Woodside is cutting 300 jobs because the oil and gas sector seems to have disconnected from mining.
Yeah, so the oil price is sitting around pretty low levels, has been since the onset of COVID, and there's sort of a generally pretty gloomy view about oil prices, driven partly by sort of macroeconomic trends, but also broader trends around energy consumption and energy generation, the shift to renewables and so on. So all sorts of broad trends that are not good for a business like Woodside. We've spoken previously about the fact that their big growth projects, Scarborough and Browse, two big offshore gas projects off the northwest coast, both been delayed, and very unclear as to when they might start getting traction again. The upshot is 300 positions have been removed. That's a bit under 10% of their total workforce.
Yep.
So quite significant. And also follows Chevron. They've made similar moves. They've been downsizing their operations, including here in Western Australia, and others in that sector. They're obviously the two big players here.
Mm.
Oil and gas, it's a tough area.
Yeah, well, you weren't actually in attendance when we had Peter Coleman a couple of weeks ago for one of our events. But when I got to interview him, one of the points he made about that was that the oil price, he suggests, tends to lag the iron ore price in these big moves by a couple of years. That's his view. So he was taking the point of view that that Woodside would be enjoying the benefits of it later. Now, Mark, there was a tragedy earlier in the week when a young man was killed on a building site at Curtin University.
Tragic news, but it's also triggered renewed debate over some legislation currently before the state parliament. The Workplace Health and Safety Bill, best known for the fact that it includes provisions for industrial manslaughter. So there was sort of a renewal of calls for that legislation to go through. It's currently before the upper house, but will probably go through next week.
Yeah.
I guess the incident at Curtin, look, obviously, it's subject to investigation, so we can't say a lot about that. I mean, I think it's one of those interesting insights as to how the construction industry works. Head contractor is Lendlease,
yep.
You know, a big international business based out of Sydney, you know, very reputable, very impressive track record over time. But of course, they're the head contractor. They bring in a bunch of specialist subcontractors to do the work. They in turn go to labour hire firms to get the bodies that actually do the work. So there's, I guess, you know, to understand construction, you need to see that sort of tiering of the workforce there. Mm. And that, of course, brings with it challenges around you know, the training and the proficiency of people within the industry.
Yeah.
Along with the fact that you get the high turnover and so on, project to project.
Yeah.
In terms of the legislation, you know, this is something that I've been following for quite some time. The I guess the headline bit that attracts a lot of attention is that the new legislation, this is part of a process of trying to align workplace legislation in every state around the country. But as part of that, there's been this very large increase in penalties and some new offences introduced.
Yeah.
So potentially, if there's a death on a worksite and there's a gross negligence on the part of the employer, they could potentially do 20 years in jail. Now, that's actually the business lobby, including the Chamber of Commerce. Well, different business groups have different views on this, but the Chamber of Commerce actually accepts that one.
Yep.
There's obviously a very high bar, very high threshold before anybody could ever be prosecuted for that. The other one that's at a lower level is where there might be a workplace accident and someone dies or there's some harm, but it's not criminal negligence, but nonetheless there's a level of responsibility on the part of the employer.
Right.
Originally there was a 10-year penalty that had been proposed. That's now been reduced to 5 years.
Right.
Nonetheless, very significant. But the debate there is whether that kind of penalty is proportionate to the offence.
Yeah, got it.
So, you know, subject to an awful lot of debate. Now, having followed this area for quite a long time and looked at prosecutions under the existing legislation, the reality is that, well, in fact, nobody has ever been prosecuted in Western Australia for the most serious, or sorry, convicted in Western Australia.
I was going to say, so successfully prosecuted, yeah.
For the most serious offence, which is gross negligence. We reported a while ago that for the first time, somebody has actually been charged with that offence. That's a company director named Sam Mangione, runs a company called Instant Waste Management. You know, there was a series of safety issues at their worksite in Bayswater. So he's the first person ever in Western Australia to face this charge of gross negligence,
right.
Under the existing legislation, which could lead to a 2-year jail term.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So look, lots of it's generated a lot of heat up in the Parliament. The Liberal Party's expressed a lot of concern about this, but it looks likely.
But the timing of this accident has an impact on all that.
Yes, but it looks likely that it will go through,
yeah.
And so therefore it'll be a significant shift for all employers and something they'll need to look at very carefully.
Yeah, no problem. Well, look, and just a side reference, a lot of building going on at Curtin, so obviously that's probably all come to a halt for a while whilst they're dealing with this, but, you know, there's literally the equivalent of a city block being built there, with 5- and 6-storey buildings, and I'm not sure how much Lendlease was across all of those or just this one building. So quite something going on out there. Now, Mark, special events for charities were big in the boom years. It seems that some groups have done well in the current times as well.
Look, this was a really positive bit of news. The Perkins Institute, one of the big medical research groups here in Western Australia, they actually had some pleasing success this year with two of their fundraising events. The most significant one is the Macca Cancer 200. That's the bike ride. Now, normally, you get 1,000 or more cyclists head off for the weekend. Now, in the world of COVID, they regretfully had to cancel that event.
Yeah.
They also have a Hawaiian Walk for Women's Cancer, That normally gets about 750 people in an old-fashioned walkathon. Also had to be cancelled. But what they did is they said to participants, well, look, go out, do your walk, do your bike ride, but do it as individuals.
Yeah, right. Report back to us.
And report back to us and do your fundraising. And it worked.
Yeah.
What were the numbers? Here we go. The bike ride raised about $3.6 million.
Yep.
Now, it's a bit below some of the boom time numbers, but
still,
I mean,
very
that's
impressive.
Spectacular.
And I thought I was told they were anticipating about a third of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think their expectations were very low when they sort of rejigged the whole thing. And the walk was raised about $900,000.
Mm,
so, you know, very pleasing news to see that these things can sort of still happen. Ironically, one of the benefits is that a lot of the costs of having, you know, a big event, like, you know, road closures and all the safety and all the marquees and all the other facilities
that go
with it.
All the volunteers you've got to manage.
You know, food and water along the route, all those things,
yep.
You didn't need them.
No.
So the costs went to...
Someone had to stop in at the cafe and get a bit of fuel up as they were riding along. That's their problem.
Yeah. So, look, hats off to all the people that participated in those. Look, a particular mention, Macca, the contracting business, they're the major sponsor for the bike ride. They had a team of about 300 people. They raised $1.6 million.
Yeah, right.
So good on Macca and all the people. And, of course, they've been a long-term supporter of this one. The event's been going for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And it raises, you know, typically sort of $4 or more million every year.
Oh, it's a great story, and very impressive, and you're right, the Macca part of that, they're real driving force behind it. So, no, wonderful news. Now, Mark, going to a slightly heavier subject again. There's a bit of tricky governance issues at some of the country's biggest companies.
Look, I think there's been several really fascinating examples this week around the governance challenges facing big companies. And it also goes to a broader theme around ESG, environmental, social and governance issues, which are increasingly to the forefront for company directors.
Yeah.
Now, one very prominent example, Rio Tinto and the backlash that they encountered over the destruction of the rock shelters up at Juukan Gorge. That topic was back in the news this week because the parliamentary hearings were underway.
Yeah.
The former chief executive, J.S. Jarks, was back before the parliamentary committee. Now, that was an example where the board thought they could tough it out. You know, they acknowledged that they'd got it wrong, but they were going to keep the existing executive team in place. And the institutional shareholders arced up and said, not good enough. Mm. We're not going to accept this. And this is the new reality for listed companies. So
yep.
J.S. Jarks and Chris Salisbury and Simone Niven all lost their jobs. And Rio's got some really tough decisions to make in terms of their board representation and who's going to take over their iron ore business.
Yeah,
the big profit generator. The other interesting one with another WA connection is Boral, big building products company.
Yep.
Now, Kerry Stokes' company, Seven Group, has been quietly lifting lifting their shareholding over the last few months. Boral's been an underperformer. They had some big issues in the US. So Seven Group has sort of moved in, got 19.9% shareholding. Following that, they went to the board and said, well, we'd like some seats on the board. And Ryan Stokes, son of Kerry, along with Richard Richards, the CFO there, were put forward as directors. And the existing board of Boral accepted that. Now, that generated a big backlash.
Yeah.
And once again, the institutional investors said, look, this is entirely disproportionate. And it's one of those, it looks like a classic Kerry Stokes move, very similar to what we saw here when he got control of West Australian newspapers.
Yeah.
Moved up to 19.9%, got board representation, then use the creep provisions to just bit by bit increase his shareholding.
Yeah, and slowly just operate it as his own asset.
Effectively sort of just gains control, and then before you know it, takes over the whole business, or as much as he wants to. So look, the backlash there, Catherine Fagg, the Borrell chair, is going to stand for re-election, but she said she'll retire next year, earlier than expected.
Right.
And Seven Group have said, well, we'll just take one board seat. The other one, Crown Resorts, you know, very big employer here in Western Australia. There's been a hearings in Sydney by the regulator there, where James Packer, amongst others, has been a witness. Amazing revelations, including the fact that James Packer, in his capacity as a shareholder, was getting special briefings from the company that no other shareholder was getting.
Yeah, and that was extraordinary.
A whole range of other issues that have been exposed there around the way that company operated, including there was a famous ad which was signed off by the board of the company, defending their practices, particularly around high-rolling gamblers. One of their directors has now admitted that that statement was incorrect after she'd signed off on it. So a lot of issues there. And then the fourth example, Virgin Airlines. Now, recently taken over by Bain Capital, big private equity group. The whole way through that takeover process, Bain declared their support for the incumbent chief executive, Paul Scurrah.
Yeah.
And that was very significant in terms of their ability to retain support from creditors and shareholders and so on. And then lo and behold, they've come out this week and so no, Paul Scurrah is not saying, and Jane Hrdlicka, who'd been an advisor to Bain, has now been brought in as chief executive.
Yeah.
Entirely contrary to all the signals they'd been given.
And it sounds like they're going to likely have a different strategy as well, with the airline go back to being more of a discount airline. Is that right?
Well, that's her background at Jetstar.
Got it. So that's the anticipation that we'll see that.
Yeah, whereas Paul Scurrah had certainly acknowledged the need to make big changes, but he'd been trying to maintain a bit more flexibility.
Yeah. And more of a full service. Mm-hmm. Yeah. More retain more of the full service airline that he'd been pushing.
Yeah. So look, I think I found it fascinating just observing these four case studies about sort of the pressures that come on company boards.
And no matter how big you are and how much, all these people well-schooled in governance and all that, it just gets awkward, doesn't it, when big, especially with big shifts come and rock the boat a bit. Yeah, fascinating. Now, Mark, just covering off on the features coming out of our magazine next week, a key special report in that magazine is the state's biggest exporters.
Yeah, Matt McKenzie has crunched the numbers it just highlights the spectacular growth that's been achieved by a lot of our biggest exporters. Now, this is research that nobody else does in the market. So if you want to find out who sits behind the WA export boom, we've got all the data here in Business News. So the names at the top of the list, Rio, BHP, and just below them Fortescue Metals, so the big three iron ore exporters. And it just shows how much growth there's been off the back of high iron ore prices. Rio, the value of their annual exports has gone from $31 billion up to about $42
billion.
So that's one company.
Nice if you can get it.
So WA's total merchandise exports last year were about $180 billion. Mm. Rio does 42, BHP does 38, Fortescue does 19.
Yeah, right.
So there's a handful of very big companies
that
are so significant. Up there as well, Gold Corporation, which of course does the refining for all the gold miners, $22 billion. Woodside Petroleum's up there very high. Chevron, they've sort of moved up the list as their Gorgon project has cranked up.
Yep.
Alcoa, Roy Hill. You get to number nine before you get out of mining and resources. That's CBH Group, so the big grain handler and exporter. And then lots of other mining companies. So, this is WA. And I guess just revisiting our earlier discussion around COVID and the fallout from it, obviously the impact on oil and gas, but the mining sector, going gangbusters.
Solid, and you know, and the fact that they've kept that going. And I guess that was, you know, the reverse has been the issue in Brazil, where their mining sector was affected by COVID. And, you know, that's helped drive up the price. So, yeah, quite an unusual. And we're a bit blessed. Thank goodness for that, eh?
Yeah, and look, you know, those border restrictions, they do make life a bit harder. Mm. And all the other, you know, safety protocols that have been introduced and so on, they make life a bit harder for the mining companies. But on balance...
Yeah,
life is going on very nicely.
And they've made a whole lot of FIFO families, you know, come here and live, which has again impacted on housing prices.
Yep.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. That's great. Have you explored our new website? Subscribers have a new feature called MyBN, which allows you to save articles, create a news feed, and follow people or organisations to get updates. Check it out or ask our subscription team about a trial. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Mark My Words with Mark Pownall and Mark Beyer from Business News. For more information, please go to businessnews.com.au/podcasts. And to receive these regularly, search for Business News WA in iTunes or SoundCloud.